still really, really mulling it over with very, very practical, relevant, applicable mitzvos that come up on a day-to-day basis. This aliyah is the exception, I hope. I hope this aliyah is not relevant to anyone. This is about the Isser of Mavir Beno Moloch. So I don't want to put anyone on the spot, but I think I'm confident to say that no one in this room has even ever considered such an Avera, but it's at least on a symbolic level very important, and that's possibly the topic of this entire aliyah, depending on how you read certain things. So as far as Parshas Kedoshim goes, it's definitely different than other aliyahs in the past few aliyahs. And let's speak about it for a moment. So first of all, Molech, as Rishon Shmuel Hirsch comments, Molech represents kind of the nexus of Avodah Zarah and Gilui Arayos, because it's an act of Avodah Zarah, and that seems to be the thrust of it, that it is a imitation of an act that was done at that time, and that seems to dictate a lot of the details. And it's also Gilui Arayos, because it's a lack of appreciation for the outcome of the physical act. The idea is that the physical act is holy and produces a wonderful bracha to serve Hashem, and take that bracha and put it through this process instead, take the offering and put it through this process instead, retroactively de-sanctifies the physical act. So that's how Rav Hirsch understands that it's both Avodah Zarah and Gilui Arayos, now making that therefore two of the big three. Now you might say, wait a minute, there's another one of the big three which seems to be an even better fit, right? So it's also Resicha. It seems to be that that's a slam dunk in this one, more clearly than it is Gilui Arayos. So probably, it's not clear that that's actually what happens though. So here, this is a little bit of somewhat synergy, or if not synergy, we have the opportunity to see other parts of Sanhedrin that we wouldn't otherwise get to with some of our parashas shiurim. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Samach Daled in the Beis talks about the pratim of Mavir Beno Moloch. It's not clear exactly what happened. It's not necessarily the case that they actually burnt him, but that they passed him over the fire as if he was jumping through the fire. So is it actually Resicha? I'm not sure. And some sources sound like a little bit. Certainly doesn't seem safe. Not something I would want my kids to do even without any idolatrous component. But in any event, I think this is pretty safe that this is the kind of aveira that we want to stay away from pretty much every angle. It's really got kind of something close to a trifecta going on as far as what's wrong with it. And I think, again, I'm not being overly optimistic when I say probably no one in this room is really planning on considering this. But Shechta sometimes relates that this is in Europe, when they wanted to criticize somebody, they'd say, oh, this guy's so terrible, he violated all the Lamed Vav priestess, all the 36 avarias you could do to be high priestess, this person is guilty of all of them. And then somebody who wanted to be Lamed Chos would say, really, it was Mefatim Masakhtoris, but some of them are a little unlikely. So here too, I think we can be, Leib Yitzchak can say, such a tzaddik, at least he never considered being Mavir Beno Moloch. Hi.
If you take the understanding that the child actually can kill, then wouldn't the Gigor also fall away?
So I think the idea is that it's a lack of respect for it. You know, it's certainly a risk. Certainly, like I said, something I wouldn't want my kids to do, regardless of whether or not it's actual strafing. So it's clearly both an act of disrespect and an act of uncaring towards the child. So it's definitely not a good thing. It's definitely not going to get you any parenting awards. So, but I think you're right that there are ways and there are sources which kind of do sound like the child is dying. So one way or another, this is definitely hovering around all of the big three, and it's something that is considered to have a unique impact on society, and that's why this aliyah is phrased also as a punishment that has to be imposed, if not through Bezdin, then by the society as a whole. So the pasuk begins, the aliyah begins, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemar, V'yol b'nei Yisrael, Tomar, Ish Ish, m'b'nei Yisrael, M'nager Hagar b'Yisrael, Asher Yitain, Mizaro, V'amolach, Mos, Yumas, Am Ha'aretz, Yirgamuhu Bo'aveh. So everyone is responsible for taking care of this person because of the profound impact that he has on society. It's interesting, Am Ha'aretz, I noticed that in the Sefer Paris Yosef, so here, Am Ha'aretz is a reference really to the people. People acting to imposed in. And we normally use Am Ha'aretz as a derogatory term nowadays. And the Gemara is also used as a derogatory term, but maybe slightly different than it is nowadays. So Makaris Yosef, he has, his voice tends to have interesting kind of comments. So he has a brief, could I guess probably be longer, but he has a brief discussion about phrases that have been interpreted both ways. So he notes in this context, talks about Amaret, and notes also that there's an expression, Sanam Ali Safri, which means basically to be a basket full of Svarim. So sometimes you'll find in Haskamas that they'll praise somebody who has tremendous Bekiyas, has tremendous knowledge and learning, and he said, Sanam Ali Safri, he's a basket of Svarim, he knows so much. So in the Gemara, it sounds like that's really a criticism. It sounds like it's a way to refer to somebody who doesn't understand what he learns, so it's just like a basket that holds the books. So the basket doesn't know anything, just has books inside of it. So too, that's the kind of person who has gone through a lot of material but doesn't have any understanding of it. So somehow these phrases sometimes change in their impact. They go from negative to positive, positive to negative. You've got to stay on top of these things, otherwise you could really end up hurting someone's feelings or embarrassing yourself. You've got to be aware of how language is applied differently in different generations. But in any event, so for a little bit of synergy here, so the pasuk here says Mizaro. So the Gemara of Sanhedrin that we mentioned has a drasha which could be very synergistic for us both recently and earlier in the year, in that the Gemara has a drasha that this chiyuv, this punishment, is for somebody who gives one of his children, but not all of his children. So why in the world should that be? Why in the world should it be that somebody who gives all of his children is less subject to punishment than somebody who only gives one? So there's a little bit evocative of the Gemara of the Sanhedrin Shekul Chayiv, that there also have a paradoxical conclusion that if everyone talks about that a little bit this week, right, that if everybody votes Chayiv, so then he's not executed, so to hear, if he takes all of his children, so he's not Chayiv the Onesh. The Rashbad is Shubas in Chelik Dalit, and Simon Yidalit quotes from the Sman that the idea is that somebody who does this to all of his children is completely evil, and therefore should not get the schus of the kapar. This, by the way, is similar to what the Marshal would later say, is the reason why we say Ein Onshin Min Adin. And also a concept we discussed this year, that the idea that somebody should not get a kapara, that if a person does one avera and there's a certain onesh, so you might think, okay, if he does a worse avera, kal chomrish, to get that onesh. So Gemara says, no, ein onshin min adin, we don't give that onesh to a kal chomer. And the Marashah says, because maybe he shouldn't earn such a kapara, that an onesh is a kapara, is also a concept that we've discussed this year. So maybe there's no such thing as a kal v'chomer. Maybe you could say that if somebody does a worse avera, he is not subject to such a kapara, and therefore should not get the onesh. So it could be that's what we're talking about here also, that we're saying that somebody who does this is pure evil, and such a person is beyond kapara, and this is not the way it's going to be dealt with. Now there's an interesting question. The Rashba, in his language, has a word which might be a wrong girsa, or might be subject to change, and it affects how you understand this, because he says somebody who would give all of his children is essentially a shote gomer. So if he's a shote gomer, that means he's insane. So maybe then his point is that he should not be punished because he's not responsible for his actions. It means he's just crazy, which we'll discuss in a minute. But some of the later Svarim suggest, based on the Rashba's other language in this tshuva, that he doesn't mean to say he's crazy. He means to say that he's a Rasha Gomer, he's a Poshea Gomer, it should be something else, He's saying that somebody who's so absolutely evil, so then this kafara is not going to be effective for him. But it could equally be that he's crazy and therefore is not responsible for his actions. And that would work well, or would work better with the Rashi's language of shota. So that's a little bit of an open question. So to extend the synergy here, so Bezalel Rudinsky has a little bit of an essay about this in a Sefer Mishkan Bezalel, which fits the topic that we're talking about this week. And he says that essentially the most dangerous thing is those people who are iffy, people who could go in both directions. So somebody who's got a number of children, and some are from Moloch and some aren't, that's where you really have a danger to society. But somebody who is going to just give all of his kids to Moloch, again, the way he writes it is a person who's just crazy. So that's not the same kind of danger to society. And in that context, he talks to bring some proofs of where it's worse to be kind of wishy-washy than to be absolutely bad. And he notes that Eliyahu HaNavi said to the people, Ad Masai Atem Postum Al Shnei HaSeifim, how long are you going to waver back and forth? If you want to worship Baal, then worship Baal. If you want to worship God, then worship God. So you ask, what do you, if you want to worship Baal, that's really an option. That's not the way we normally think. Right? So why would that be better? So apparently sometimes you just have to say, listen, you can't be half here and half there. That's going to cause more of a problem for society. Just decide who you are and accept the consequences. And he says that's also pshat, that when Rivka was pregnant with Yaakov and Esau, and she was all upset, and she said, Lamaza Nofi, what's going on? Because she heard this rumbling, and when she would, Rashi explains, when she would pass a church, and she would pass a shul, both times she would hear this rumbling. So she went to the Chacham, and the Chacham told her that Shnei Goyim B'Bneich, you have two nations in your belly. So why is that better? Why did that make her feel better? So he explains that she thought she had one child who was somewhere in the middle, was half her Torah, half her Avodah Zarah, so that was going to be very difficult to deal with. But if she had one child who was for Torah, one child was for Avodah Zarah, okay, that was something that she could deal with a little bit more. So he discusses all this in the context of this unique drasha, and it's a little bit evocative of what we just discussed about the Daimon says, I don't know. And the Daimon says, I don't know, so we can't deal with him. We don't know what to do. He doesn't really contribute to the conversation. He takes away from the effectiveness of the other Daimon, so we can't deal with that. If we have a Daimon who says the opposite of what everyone else says, him we can deal with it. But when he's wishy-washy, so then that causes problems, and perhaps that's a little bit synergistic as far as this is concerned. The chinuch has a suffix about whether this onesh applies equally to the mother of the child also. And it's not clear why it should make a difference. I mean, if it's an issue of the Avodah Zarah, so normally men and women are equally subject to prohibitions of Avodah Zarah. In fact, there are some makoros that say that explicitly here. So what's the suffix about? In the Sefer Chavetz Hashar, he has a discussion that maybe since this is about copying a certain practice that existed at that time, so maybe that was the tzura of the practice. The tzura of the practice was that the father brings the child for Moloch. So therefore, it's not a tour of Nashim. It's not a question of whether you're a man or a woman. I don't know how well this kind of argument will go over nowadays. In some of the contexts we say, it's not about whether you're a man or a woman. It's just about whether you're a father or a mother. That if you're the father, so that's the tzura of this idea of Mavrim Nol Moloch. And therefore, that's where the onus specifically is. He goes on to say, he thinks that's also, when we talk about the mothers being patur from bris milah, we say that the father is chayav to give a bris milah to his son and the mother is not. He thinks it's a similar kind of idea. It's not that women are patur from bris milah. There's a whole discussion in the Rishonim. Is it mitzvah seisha as man grama? Is it not? Why do we need a pasuk? Why do we not need a pasuk? So he wants to suggest that the whole nature of that din is not to say that women are patur from bris milah. It's to say that the chiyuv is on fathers, not that the chiyuv is on men as opposed to women, but the nature of this mitzvah is that the father has to give his son a bris milah. So similarly, he thinks maybe that's the idea here also, maybe that's what the Sefer HaChinuch is getting at, and that's why also the Gemara has a drasha that even if it's an illegitimate child, you still consider that to be zaro for this purpose, even though you could question in other contexts whether that's considered to be zaro. And here also, it's because that's the tzura of the Isser. He thinks the tzura of the action was that the father brings his offspring. So it's the father and not the mother, and it's offspring, whether it's legitimate offspring or illegitimate offspring. Okay, so we'll just go a little further here. So then the pasuk goes on to put really a very significant responsibility on behalf of the surrounding people. So can we go on to say, "Vani etain es panai b'ishahu v'chrati oso mikerav amo ki mizaron asam amolach l'man tamei es mikdashi l'chalel l'shem kodshi." God says, "I'm really going to pay attention to this person because he has caused real harm to his environment, and he has defiled the mikdash, and he's created a chilul Hashem, and everyone else should pay attention to him." Imi halei yalimu am haaretz es einei minishahu b'sito mizaron amolach. So all of this is responsibility of society to pay attention to what's going on. So if you look in the Ramban here, there's an interesting Ramban that has a comment which is a little bit tangential, but it's a topic of some discussion, and you might want to be ma'ayin into it. So, for example, if you look in the Sefer Som Derech, which is the Sichos of Rav Simcha Zussel Brody of Chevron, and also if you look in the Lahoris Nasan on Chumash, Nasan Gishtetner and Chumash, they both have several pages about this Ramban, really a tangential point, but I'll just call your attention to it, and you can choose to look there if you want to be ma'ayin in this further. That Ramban has this idea that this person who's doing this is causing the Shechina to leave the Jewish people, and it's having an impact on the environment around him. And he is, again, like we mentioned before, taking the product of God's bracha, and instead of using it for his service, is diverting it in a very terrible way. And he has a comparison there, which is the topic of a lot of discussion. He says that this is similar to what the Gemara says, that kol hanena me'olam hazad lo bracha ki'ilu mol. That if somebody eats food in this world and doesn't make a bracha on it, so then it's as if that's an act of me'ilah, it's as if that's an act of theft. So what they note is that it sounds like from his comparison that he has an unusual understanding that in the later sources, and probably what I would ask you if I stop you on the street and ask you what that did means, so you probably say that it's the way Marsha says it, the way Maral writes it in his writings, and I think also again in a more intuitive way, is that the idea the Gemara has that you are stealing from God if you eat without a bracha. So what are you stealing? What would you say? Well, what are you stealing? Where's the theft? So I think if you wanted to say something, you'd probably say that you're stealing the food. That sounds like from the Gemara, right? The guy says, here's the food, but it's only yours if you pay for it with a bracha. So if you take it without a bracha, so you are stealing it. But it sounds like from the Ramban, and maybe from also Das Kedem Bali Atosfos, a few others also, that the issue is that you're stealing the bracha. That God gave this gashmius in the world as an opportunity for you to honor him. And by passing up that opportunity, so you are kviyachol stealing away the bracha. So that's a whole different understanding. That's where the Ramban finds a comparison here to this idea of molech, of taking that which should be a good source of glory and covet to God, and diverting it to avodah zarah and to risk or harm or death. So in that context, that's how the Ramban makes this comparison. But it's a different understanding than we otherwise would have had. So, from a lumdish perspective, this might explain something, though. So this is not discussed, if I'm not mistaken, those far as Sandar and the Loris Nassim, but you can build on what they say. Again, they have a pretty lengthy analysis, both of them, about how to understand that whole din of Nenem Olam Azav Lo Bracha. But there is an interesting machlokas that we know we normally say that Safek Derabanan Lahakel. If you don't know whether or not you're obligating the din b'rabbanan, so you're makel, and you apply that to brachos. Right? So we have a concept of safek brachos l'hakel b'mamon. So if you're not sure whether you're chayiv in a bracha, so we say, leave it out. So that is probably an application of the klal of suffik brachos, of suffik drabanan lahakel, because brachos are generally drabanan except for brachos hamazon. So therefore, if we're not sure if we're obligated, we should leave it out. Sometimes we wonder, maybe it's also a reflection of the concern of a suffik daraisa, of shem Hashem l'shav. That might not be an issue, maybe we'll come back to that in a minute, but it's probably driven by suffik drabanan lahakel. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger, on the side of the page of the Gemara in Maseches Brachos and Daf Yud Aleph, has a point which he actually quotes from a Marsha, that why should it be that a suffik bracha should be lahakel? If I want to eat something, and I'm not sure if I need to make a bracha or not, so then I'm not allowed to eat it. And we said that it's as if you're stealing from God, so therefore, it's a suffik iser, basically. It's a suffik gezel from God. So therefore, I'm going to have to make a bracha to deal with that. So he writes, according to Marsha and Pesachim, that this din of suffik brachas lahakel must not apply to a bracha rishon. A bracha rishon, one has to be machmir on because it's a suffik of stealing from God. So the Achronim did not accept this. This isn't the way we assume. Shlomo Zalman has a truth about this. Others write about this, that this isn't practice. So it could be, you could understand it, maybe based on this Ramban, that it's not that we're worried about stealing the food. It's that we're worried about stealing the bracha, not giving this opportunity to show this covenant to God. So that only exists if there's a chiyuv bracha. If there's a chiyuv bracha, so then we don't do it, we're losing that opportunity. But if the rules are, there's no chiyuv bracha, because something bracha sahaka, whatever it is, so then there isn't anything that's being stolen, so there is no concern. This matches the idea in general, which you alluded to a minute ago, that you might say, well, suffik brachos lahakel also, because it's a suffik of taking God's name in vain. So that's an issur d'oraisa. So probably not, as Rav Shlomo Zalman also points out in the Tshuva, that it's probably not an issur d'oraisa to make a bracha l'batal. Even though it sounds like in the Gemara that it is, the Gemara says that if someone makes a bracha l'batal, it's a violation of l'vsis Hashem Hashem l'kecha l'shav, but a lot of the Rishonim assume that that's an asmach. That you have to say that if you're praising God, Tzura Sabracha, that's not called taking God's name in vain, even if the bracha is not really justified. If you're going to make a random mezonos right now, so you're not chayiv in that. But it's hard to call that Nisra Daraisa Shem Hashem Olkecha L'Shav, because you are praising God. You're praising God in the form of a bracha, so that's not called taking His name in vain. So therefore, you have to assume, as Rav Shlomo Zalman explains, that if you were to say that's a real issur d'oraisa, so then what you're saying is that when Chazal told us to make 100 brachos a day, so they are basically suspending that issur d'oraisa 100 times a day. It's hard to believe. We have a little more synergy. We discussed this year that sometimes Chazal do suspend Torah law, but Kulihai, such an extent that they would say that 100 times a day should override Nisra D'Raisa, it's unlikely. Presumably, that's not really Nisra D'Raisa. And Chazal innovated brachos, and when they innovated brachos, they also, together with that, innovated this idea that you should not make a bracha when it's not obligatory. So, brachos are a chiyuv d'rabbanan, and the isser of the bracha of atala, bracha shenitzricha, is also an isser d'rabbanan. So, it's a function of whether or not there is a chiyuv bracha in the first place. So presumably that's the answer to the lumdus over there. And that all could correspond to what this Ramban is maybe getting at, that the issue is not that you're stealing the food, the issue is that you're passing up an opportunity to make a bracha. And that's the sense in which he compares it to Mola. So this is somewhat of a tangent, but essentially the whole Aliyah is all about Mola and related themes. Possible. The possible exception is the last pasuk. But that's a little bit of a discussion. So is the last pasuk about this or about something else? So what does the last pasuk say? V'hiskadishtem, v'yistem kedoshim, ki ani Hashem Elokeichem. So you shall sanctify yourselves and you should be holy. So what's that talking about? So if you look at Rashi, it's talking about the topic of this Aliyah. It's saying stay away from Avodah Zarah. So all of this is about Avodah Zarah, and just like kedoshim, Rashi says at the beginning of the parasha, Kedoshim Tiyu means Prushim and Arayus. So here he says it means Prushim from Avodah Zarah. So we're just talking about Avodah Zarah, so stay away from that. There is a drasha the Gemara has in Maseches Brachos that says Vizkadishtem Visem Kedoshim. Vizkadishtem is a reference to Mayim Rishonim. Visem Kedoshim is a reference to Mayim Achronim. So is this the pasuk that we're talking about? So it's not clear. If you look in the Torah Tamima, here and elsewhere, so there's a pasuk, he's Kadishtem Visem Kedoshim and Parashat Shmini. And the pasuk ends differently. And it's a question which one is the source for the Gemara about Mayim Achronim. There's a whole discussion about it here in the Sefer Hegel and HaParsha. It's a little bit of a toss-up because there's some clues in one way, some clues in the other way. The Torah Tamima notes that that pasuk in Parashat Shmini is the one that's in the context of Tumah Vatara, so that's presumably the relevant context. Well, here we're talking about Moloch. We're not going to go off into tangents and other subjects. It doesn't have any relevance to this. So just to say a quick word about the whole concept, because we're not the suffix whether it's within our purview as a Chamishi of Yoshim or not, but so the Gemara has this statement that Mayim Rishonim Mitzvah, Mayim Achronim Chova, that there's a more of an obligation of Mayim Achronim than there is on even Mayim Rishonim, which to us seems a little bit paradoxical because we're much more machbid on Mayim Rishonim nowadays than we are on Mayim Achronim. So there's a whole discussion why that is. So what's the real reason for Mayim Achronim, and does that indicate whether we should do it nowadays or not? So there's a lot to say about this. A lengthy discussion again in the Sefer Yoni Aparsha if you want to take a look. But just to focus on some of the more well-known ideas, so there is a notion that the Gemara talks about Melech Sedomis, the sodomite salt that people used to have at their tables that could blind them if it stayed on their fingers and they rubbed their eyes with their fingers. So for safety reasons, we have to wash our hands off. So Tosfos says in Chulin and Daf Kuf Hey that nowadays we're not so machbid anymore because we don't have this Melech Sedomis. And you find other explanations in some Sfarim why we're not so machbid. We eat the knife and fork. Other reasons why maybe it's less of an issue nowadays than it once was. So that's the whole discussion. Some of the Rishonim say, like Tosfos, that we don't have to worry about it anymore. And others disagree. So among those who disagree is the Aruch HaShulchan, which is a little bit surprising. Aruch HaShulchan very often is a Malam Eitz Chosim in Klal Yisrael. Here he's coming to take a different attitude. He's saying, don't listen to that Tosfos. Because maybe Tosfos is only coming to the Malam Eitz Chosim, but not to say that Aruch HaShulchan shouldn't do it. So the Aruch HaShulchan takes a pretty hard line on this, which is consistent that his son, the Torah Tamima, also assumes like that. As far as I can tell, he doesn't refer to his father and his strong position on it. But he maintains that if it was just about cleanliness and about some kind of sodomite salt, so then we could say, like Tosfos, that maybe it's not relevant anymore. But the drasha, which again he thinks is the pasuk from Parashat Shmini in the context of Tumah Vatara, so it's telling you that l'shem birchas hamazon, that's a part of the requirement that if you're going to then, that pasuk goes on to say, ani Hashem, you're going to therefore declare God's glory, so it's only appropriate to do that in a context of Tara, so you should purify yourself and therefore be pure, and in that context, you should bless God. So this is an ongoing debate, but the one thing we could agree that if you have to choose between Molech and Mayim Achronim, definitely go for Mayim Achronim. Okay, so, but it's not such a common scenario. Okay, so let's try to spend a few more minutes now talking about Sanhedrin. So I think we left off in the middle of Shari yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, right? So what was the last thing we said? I think we talked about the reasons for Rov. Let's get out Arya's excellent notes again. Maybe this was it.
On page 361, if that helps.
Okay, page 61 in our notes.
Yeah.
They have page numbers?
I needed a PDF.
Well, that's where Char starts, but he already started yesterday.
All right, let's start from here. Okay, so Shara, as we mentioned, has in some ways, something to do with Din. In some ways, it's different. It's connected to Din. In some ways, different than Din. So one of the things that we talked about was the question of if the Shdim Mishur Sadin, which we spent a lot of time explaining yesterday, that if the Shdim Mishur Sadin means that you can factor in the different elements of the story. So we said yesterday that one of the justifications, one of the bases for the Shdim Mishur Sadin, is to say that I'll have Rachmanas on the Ani. So how would you apply that here? Because normally we know that when it comes to Din, so you're not allowed to be in Rachim on the Ani. So if we assume, as indeed is the case, as Rav Soloveitchik emphasized, and as you already see in Shulchan Aruch, that all the dinim will say shochad and have not shown favorites apply to Pshara as well. So what about this? One of the rules is that a dayan can't have more rachmanas on the poor guy than on the rich guy. So how does that apply? Do we say that that carries over to Pshara? So we had a couple of suggestions that we'll say that maybe you have to say that in a chanami you can't do that. And that's a little bit hard to say, that this is not something you can factor in. Or you could say that that's going to be an exception because this is something that's consistent with the process of Pshara as opposed to personal favoritism. Or we also mentioned that maybe it depends how it's presented, that essentially you can say that, listen, you are obligated as a matter of staka to support this person, and therefore we're telling you that you have to factor that into how things are divided here. As opposed to if you're going to say that, oh, because I have Rachmanis on the poor person, I'm going to make it seem like he's more justified in the din. So maybe it's a question of presentation. So those were some of the approaches we took to that question. Okay, the idea of not making a distinction between Shara Krov Ladin and Stam Shara and the Rav, we talked about that yesterday. So the Gemara says that we need a kinyan for Pshara. Or at least it's a machlokas in the Gemara. So why should we need a kinyan specifically for Pshara and not for Din? So it seems like the kinyan is there to create the obligation to follow through. And yet, Rav Ashi doesn't require the kinyan. So why not? So apparently Rav Ashi holds that the fact that they agreed to come to this Pshara, so that itself is a commitment through their words. But others assume that that's not going to be enough, and you're going to need the kinyan. So why do you need the kinyan? So it seems like the concern is asmachta. That maybe if you're going to accept this din, maybe we run the risk that that's going to be considered an asmachta, because maybe you're not going to be happy with how the results turn out. And we discussed that could come from a couple of places. One, that you don't know how it's going to work out for you, better or worse. Or, especially, because you don't even know what kind of numbers we're talking about. And that's especially a problem for the Rambam. And the Rambam says that a Dovish Eino Katsuv is not going to work, even with a kinyan. So here, Soloveitchik explained that the reason it works here with the kinyan is because it's not that you are committing to a specific number, but rather you're committing to what the dayanim say. You're basically committing to their das. Okay. All right, so far so good. So we talked about a few other perspectives on this. That Mari Basam, who thought that Pshara was a completely different concept than Din. Shvus Yaakov thought it was like Shuda. Shuda is one of the cases that comes up in the Gemara, one of the methods for resolving between people. where it seems like Adonian basically uses his judgment. And it sounds like, at least according to some opinions in the Rishonim, the Adonian basically could just say whatever he wants, almost up to bribery. Tosus asked that question, that if you're going to say, you can say whatever you want, then why can't you be bribed? So the Tosus says, no, bribery means your mom is not a judge. But outside of bribery, the Adonian can use whatever he wants to come to such a conclusion. But we see that our general understanding is no, that it's neither of those, that here we're talking about extra half for das, and kidei kach, like the Ramban, the Shulchan Aruch quote, we have this prohibition of hatoya, that you can't tilt it in, that you have to be very straight about it. The Bach has a chiluk that a dayan, even though he can't get paid for the actual process of din, but he can be paid for pshara. And here the Pesach Shuv explains that we're not talking about a bribe, we're talking about the separate isra of mani v'chinam, that normally a dayan shouldn't get paid for time, he gets paid for the time that he's not using, schar batala, he doesn't get paid for the actual process of din, because of mani v'chinam. The Rosh in the Gemara, that God says mani v'chinam, that just like I gave you the Torah, I taught you Torah for free, so too you shouldn't charge for teaching Torah. So, why should it be different here? So, you could say, and we're discussing this with Iris, I think, maybe after we discuss it here. So, you could say, in keeping with what we said before, that the Dayan is not actually conveying Torah here, that one is conveying Din. So, that becomes abstract Torah. So, the Dayan is essentially, when he's practicing Din, is teaching Torah, and we say, Mani Bechina. But here, the Dayan is actually conveying something else. Like we said yesterday, maybe one of the reasons Rove doesn't work is because it's not an abstract din that's irrelevant with Doros. It's only relevant to these two people. So maybe that's not called teaching Torah, and therefore the din of Mani Bechinam doesn't apply. We mentioned the difference where it's a little bit harder, because if you say that normally a Dayan shouldn't get paid because he's performing a mitzvah like a doctor, so he's doing what he has to do, so then why should that be any less for someone who's involved in pshara? If we say pshara is an even bigger mitzvah, so then all the more so we shouldn't get paid. Unless you want to say that a pshara is not obligatory, he did, he has to do, and a pshara is not obligatory, and maybe that's why you're not going to apply to a mani tachinam or apply to the issur of getting paid. Okay. So, in the interest of time, let's see, maybe skip around a little bit, what do we want to make sure to include? So, basically, just to give you a basic guideline, I think two more things that we just should make sure to go over is, we also talked about how pshara has a limitation of when you already know where things are headed, once you reach the Gemara Din, so then you can no longer offer a pshara, or no longer make a pshara. And then that also gets into the whole sugya of Lo Saguru, which it seems like we're not going to have so much time to go into in detail. But this idea that, so just, that's just to outline what's left. But basically, as far as this idea that there's a limit to when you can do a pshara, so that's an interesting question. So Rashi says that it means that you have already declared what the din is. And Tosfos says that it means that you're just about to, you've done everything but declared who the din is. So it sounds like, from Rashi's perspective, that the din is now already been established and cannot be undone through pshara, as some have pointed out. Maybe you can't have a fair pshara at that point when the litigants know already what the story is, in terms of willingness and the like. Tosus is focusing on that you're deceiving the person, that the person thinks that everything's open and maybe his odds are better if he accepts pshara, and therefore, since he doesn't know, the assumption is that if he knew that things were already all but settled, then maybe he wouldn't accept the pshara. We had some question about that from our idealistic perspective, that you would think that maybe the person would agree to pshara even if he knows that he would be better off without it monetarily, because he's interested in shalom. But apparently that's not the premise that we're working off here, as far as at least dealing for everybody. So that's also a discussion. The Shach quotes from Shulti Gibarim that after the din, so the Bali din could still decide the pshara themselves, and the dying could be involved in convincing them. So all we mean, and then he goes on to say, that's a big mitzvah, you should do that. So we just mean that the dying can't force them to do a pshara at that point. So I, dying, can never force them to do a pshara. So the Ashur Shlomo explains that Ashur Shlomo is a type of son-in-law, that yes, pshara begins off as voluntary. But once you start the pshara, so then that becomes a dependence on the das of the judges, as we've seen. But here, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about if they together themselves decide that they will accept the pshara, that they can nudge them in that direction, so then that's better off for everybody. Okay. So I'm trying to decide from a time perspective how to make a pshara here, what else to talk about. I mentioned here the Shalva Meshiv, that another reason why the pshara can't happen after the Gemar Din is because the Dayanim have basically made a reality, and so now money is owed from one part or the other, and there might be a third party who has a debt from that winner, and if you're going to change it at this point, you could be taking money away from the third party. I mentioned also Ben Tziv, who used this idea of knowing where the din is going to go. He pointed to Aaron and Moshe, that since the Gemara seems to say that Moshe didn't make pshara, Moshe was Yiko v'din Sahar, so the Nesiv said that, like Das Tosfos, that if you know where things are holding already, you shouldn't make a pshara, and Moshe was so fast with the din, so he already was holding by that point. That doesn't necessarily affect other dayan. And Cheshav HaEifod, dying from London, says that the Gemara situation, it sounds like the Beis Din was already in a situation of din, and then they want to flip to pshara in the middle. So it's one thing to start off from pshara, but if you're going to flip to din in the middle, so then, he says, in that situation you can follow Rov, because the assumption is that they didn't come expecting a three-panel Beis Din. That's based on the understanding we mentioned before, that the idea that they accept a unanimous opinion only is when they start off with that type of agreement for pshara. But if you flip in the middle, then it doesn't necessarily have to apply. And the Meiri has an unusual interpretation that the idea that you can't have pshara at the Gemar Din means that at that point the responsibility is that the Bali Din have to be able to perceive the Shalom within the din, recognize that that's the will of Shemayim, and that there's a peace in that also, and that the Beis Din's obligation at that point is to make them realize that. And we mentioned in that context that din and shara shouldn't really be perceived as complete opposites. There are different points along the spectrum that we believe that pure din really does represent Shalom, but it's hard in this world sometimes to perceive that, so we acknowledge that, and we therefore have room for a more understandable type of system of the pshara. But even din by itself has this core of shalom, and it's important to appreciate that when it comes to that also. Okay, so we mentioned also that one of the situations where a dayan could compel pshara is also if he's trying to do din, but he sees that people are lying and it's not working. So that's comparable to a situation in which there's no possibility of din, and therefore pshara could be imposed on the seaboard. And we mentioned how that was the opposite of a story of Reb Chaim, where somebody asked him in Yiddish to make a pshara because he was in din with a non-Jew, and Reb Chaim recognized that he was lying, and that's why he wanted a pshara, so therefore he imposed din. So here we're saying the opposite, that if the dayanim can't get justice because people are lying, so then that's an exception, and that's a case where they can impose pshara on that case. The Rabbaz writes also that if they simply don't have any access to the facts, if they don't know what's going on, so that's all similar to the case in the Gemara later on the Beis, that it's impossible to actually get the justice, and therefore you can impose a pshara. All right, so let's just say a few quick words about Lo Sagur B'Fnei'ish. So we saw, just a lot of detail, which I'll ask you to look at your own, look at the chazer on your own, but you did it relatively recently, so hopefully it's a little fresher, but just to highlight some of the key themes. So the Gemara has basically two drushes. The Gemara has a drasha that a dayan who knows at a certain point when he's already been involved enough that he knows where things are going, so then he can't pull out, and that a Talmud who's watching and who knows something to say, so he can't hold back. And it was suggested that maybe they're all one din. That's the question we mentioned that the Achronim discussed, whether this is a lav shebeklolos, is this one losa say that has a number of different makoros, or is it two applications of the same idea? That maybe it's all the same idea, that if you're the one who can make a difference, then you have to follow through, whether you're a Talmud who knows there's a mistake, or whether you're a Dayan who's the one in charge and you've heard things enough, or as the Shulchan Aruch quotes, if you are the Mamuna, if you're the one whose job it is to deal with this, so then you're ready, considered to be somebody who can't pull out. All of that is consistent with that kind of understanding. And we also spoke about the overall question of whether it's an Aveira ben Adam l'Chaveira ben Adam l'Makom, that who are you helping here? Are you helping your friend get justice? And that's what you can't refrain from? Or are you helping God make sure that there is truth, like the Pasuk says, Kamishpat Elokimhu? And that could have ramifications. We discussed whether it's Yehari Wal Yavor, because it sounds like you can't be afraid of anything. So most assume that it's not really Yehari Wal Yavor, because it's kind of a far-off concern, even though the Rambam has language in the Midrashic literature where the Dayan might say, oh, maybe he'll kill my child, maybe he'll set fire to my house, whatever it is. So on the one hand, it sounds like there's a real suffix b'kuach nefesh. On the other hand, it sounds like it's mixed in with other things, so maybe he's just worrying about it without real justification. So that was a discussion in Poskim, whether it's really Harav Yavor or not. We discussed how could it be Harav Yavor. So you could say that either this is like the Ziyaf HaTorah, that at this point where you're going to really affect the MS of how the din is carried out, then you can't let that fall. And especially like in the sense of if it's going to be the Wild West, if there's nobody else who can take care of this, so then like we find in other contexts that there are people whose job requires them to lay their lives on the line in order to keep society running. So that might be what's going on here. And that was also relevant in this question of whether it is Yehar Vayavar, whether it's Ben Adam Chaver or Ben Adam Makom. And even if you say it's not Yehar Vayavar, like most say, so the question of, so why shouldn't you have to spend all your money? Why shouldn't you at least allow yourself to be subject to material risk in order to avoid this issue? So some say, you know, Hanami, you are obligated to go through material risk. And others say you aren't. So the question might be also, well, what type of isser is it? If it's an isser ben adam l'makom, so then you should be obligated to risk all your money in order to fulfill it. If it's an isser ben adam l'chaveiro, so it's probably similar to Shavas Aveda, so you have to make sure your friend doesn't lose out, but not at the expense of you losing out. So if you're going to go through such risk, so then that's the perhaps the most intuitive answer. There are a few other approaches also, that maybe it's a passive love, that's different rules, maybe it's Xeris Akasu. All of these suggestions, again, a lot more than we said about this, but this is just a short overview. Okay, any basic questions? Any broader questions? All right, so I apologize for the scheduling quirks yesterday, today, I guess tomorrow. So tomorrow, Bez Hashem, we're scheduled for 11 o'clock here in this room. If you have any questions, next...